Good evening, everyone. So tonight I'd like to talk about letting go. And one way we might talk about letting go is as a ripening. And for me, I think this is quite a potent and poetic way to approach the notion of letting go, because it points us clearly to the cyclic or process nature of life and of our Dharma practice. When something is ripe, we say it's reached maturity, that it's fully grown, it's ready or seasoned. And I have an orange tree in a pot, in a big pot at home, and for the last 20 or so years I've been nurturing it with compost and water and mulch and regular food and some conversations every now and then with it, some pruning and, you know, yeah, refining the location of it. And as the fruit forms each year, I wait and I watch and continue to provide care. Essentially, I'm creating the conditions the plant needs in order to grow good fruit. So I don't focus on the oranges themselves, but on what's going to create nice plump oranges. And with our Dharma practice, we do the same thing. We're in the process of creating nice plump oranges of ourselves. We keep setting the right conditions by putting into practice the Buddha's example and his teachings, and we attend to our own experience. So we set these conditions that we notice result in less suffering, that create a flourishing life, and that keep moving us towards maturity or ripening. And I don't tell my oranges to hurry up or sit by them with a clock, timing their ripening. I simply know when they're ready because of how they feel in my hand or how they look to my eye or how they smell. It's very natural. I don't have to think about it. And similarly, with our practice, we can't force ripening or letting go to happen. As the great Thai forest meditation master Ajahn Chah says, looking for peace is like looking for a turtle with a moustache. You won't be able to find it. But when your heart is ready, peace will come looking for you. So looking for peace, for freedom, is just a concept, because from where we are now, we might say from a place of unripeness or ripening, it's only an idea. But we still assume we know what we're looking for. And as Ajahn Chah says, we might as well be looking for a turtle with a moustache. But we can make sure our heart is ready by learning to come to understand how and why we suffer and how and why we flourish. So as we keep showing up for this project, which takes, you know, time and dedication and plenty of good humour, I think, we keep refining the conditions that naturally produce the fruits of the practice, that will naturally ripen us. And we find peace, inadvertently, knocking at our door. In other words, we realise that letting go is already happening. So if we keep showing up, and keep inquiring into the nature of this human condition, we're already loosening things up. We might say, isn't ripening already happening? Isn't letting go already happening? Peace is already happening, bit by bit. And Ajahn Chah also said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you'll have complete peace. And while we hear a lot about letting go in Buddhism, and we've been talking about this quite a bit on this retreat, letting go, we might say, is the whole of the path. But this letting go can only happen in the context of also knowing what to hold on to, the qualities and tools that are going to be helpful that we actually need on the journey. So if you're a bushwalker, you know, just like the packs that we take with us if we go out bushwalking, filled with, you know, good quality, warm, protective clothing, food, first aid, a dry tent, a warm sleeping bag, some good walking boots, you know, all the things essential to being safe and protected in the wilderness. In the same way, we need the teachings, the practices, the Buddha as inspiration, and all those who have come before us to provide guidance and a sense of what we need to walk wisely through this life. So an image the Buddha gives us here is of a raft that you use to get across the river to the other shore, which is code for awakening. Once you reach the other shore, which is the free heart mind, you don't need the raft anymore. But until then, the support of the raft is crucial. It takes you across the rapids and the currents and the eddies of this river that we call life. So we need the support of things like the foundation of ethical principles. You know, these principles, these guiding principles in life of non-harming and the protection of life, of not taking what isn't given and protecting others' belongings. You know, of sensual and energetic care of ourselves and others, taking care with speech and care with what we consume, that we don't, you know, get intoxicated by whatever we consume. And we also need present moment awareness of body and breath. You know, these practices that we're engaging in together this retreat based on mindfulness. Mindfulness is the key. Bhikkhu Anālayo calls it our good friend, sati. And the felt continuity of that. You know, this the collectedness, the samadhi that we've been developing through continuing to settle and soften the body and the heart and mind. You know, these are valuable supports on the path. And we need discernment, wisdom. When we investigate the body and heart-mind over time, clear seeing arises. And as this clarity builds, deeper understanding about the nature of body and heart-mind is generated. In other words, we see the Dharma more clearly. And so when that happens, the path to living a wiser, more ethical life becomes clearer. It becomes like a natural unfolding. And we need faith. We need faith in our own experience. And we can take faith in the Buddha's experience and the teachings that he so freely gave us and what they lead to. And we need each other. We need each other on this path. We can't walk this path alone. We need others in the raft with us, you know, a community of teachers, fellow practitioners, the knowledge of others who've already crossed this river before us and can show us the way. So we don't put everything aside. You know, these rafts and all the supports that we pile in the raft with us help us develop skillful qualities of the citta in order that we can, you know, safely and with confidence, actually, you know, with this faith, with confidence, move towards letting go. So we might say then that we hold on in service of letting go. You know, this is part of the discernment, what to hold on to and what to let go aside. So this is the paradox of the path. And then in the fire of our own heart-mind's refinement, letting go, ripening, happens naturally. And it's revealed in the way that we start flowing with life, yeah, with nature. The world starts looking different to us because our relationship with everything starts changing. We can hold our suffering more lightly, and this doesn't mean that life stops being painful. It's just that we change how we relate with what feels painful. Yeah? And we sense a deeper embodied presence. We feel a sense of being here more often. And wisdom and compassion are more regular companions on the path. You know, we can draw on our wisdom and our open heart more regularly. And moments of joy visit more regularly as well. So sometimes there's a sudden revelation of deep insight which results in a distinct shift of perspective, a profound release. You know, just like this. Once on retreat, this happened when suddenly I saw the futility of my trying to get rid of what I saw as the problem of striving in my life. I realized with a shock one day that the very struggle I need to let go was striving. It was the self clinging on to this concept that I had about letting go. So in an instant, I felt my whole being relax deeply. I didn't have to demonize striving anymore. It was just a habit, conditioning, that I'd kept clinging to. And I was addicted to the feeling that was present when I was striving, because it felt familiar and strangely pleasant, even as it became painful. It's relatable anyway. Maybe it's just me. But all I did was see clearly. It was this seeing clearly the whole constellation. And in that moment, the struggle disappeared. It dissolved. It let go of me. Its life force was suddenly drained. So I didn't do anything. Well, I'd been doing the practice, but I'd let go of something that had hold of me. So sometimes letting go can be intense and momentary like this, and very transformative. And I heard this story years ago, and it comes to me sometimes when I feel myself getting caught up in something and trying to control something. It's the story of Chuck Yeager. I don't know if any of you know it. So in his book, The Right Stuff, Tom Wolfe describes how in the late 1950s, a few highly trained pilots were attempting to fly at altitudes higher than had ever been achieved. Yeah. And the first pilots to face this challenge responded by frantically trying to stabilize the planes when they went out of control. So they were applying correction after correction but because they were way out of the Earth's atmosphere, the rules of thermodynamics no longer applied. So the planes were just going went crazy. And the more furiously the pilots tried manipulating the controls, the wilder the rides came. And tragically, these first pilots would scream helplessly to ground control, "What do I do next?" And several of them apparently plunged to their deaths. And this occurred several times before one of the pilots, Chuck Yeager, accidentally struck upon the solution. When his plane began to tumble, Yeager was thrown violently around in the cockpit and he was knocked unconscious. So unconsciously, his plane plummeted towards Earth. And 7 miles later, apparently, the plane re-entered the planet's, the denser atmosphere, and the navigation equipment started working again, and he obviously came to, and so he took control again, steadied the plane, and landed. So in doing so, he discovered the only life-saving response that was possible in this situation. Don't do anything. Let go. Take your hands off the controls. And I think it can be a helpful image. This is how it is in our lives sometimes too. When we feel like things are spinning madly, what's the first response? Our habitual response is to hold on tight and try whatever we can to right things in our minds. But can we trust life enough to take our hands off the controls, i.e. stop doing what we've always done, stop doing what we think we should be doing, and let go completely? As the philosopher and social commentator Bayu Akamalafe says, falling might very well be flying without the tyranny of coordinates. So if we leave aside our concepts about where we think we are at any point in time and where we think we should be, and open our mind to just what is right now, with no strictures of coordinates or other, conceptual boxing in, what might the possibilities be? David Wagoner wrote a poem called Following a Stream, and it expresses this mystery of, taking our hands off the controls and not knowing where it's taking us, letting ourselves fall or fly rather than clinging on. He says, "Don't do it," the guidebook says, "if you're lost." Then it goes on to talk about something else, taking the easy way out, which of course is what water does as a matter of course, always taking whatever turn the earth has told it to, while and since it was born, including flowing over the edge of a waterfall, or simply disappearing underground for a long, dark time, before it reappears as a spring so far away from where you thought you were and where you think you are, it might never occur to you to imagine where that could be as you go downhill. So letting go is happening all the time when we open and meet life without agenda. When we put aside, thinking we know where we should be, letting go is happening every time we take a breath and let it go. If we let that breath go, we're already letting go. So often letting go doesn't feel that dramatic, and we might only recognize the ripening has actually occurred sometime later, when we reflect back and we realize that, the way I responded to that certain situation, or the way I was in relationship with that person right then, something's changed. We recognize a relaxation or a non-reactivity to something that would have once, created great tension. So we find ourselves somewhere we never imagined we'd be if we tried planning it with the rational mind. So remember that letting go, or flying, doesn't look like anything in particular, just as water can look variously like river, stream, waterfall, cloud, spring, ocean, iceberg, mist. Because letting go isn't a thing. And this is an important point. Letting go isn't anything because it's just the presence of an absence. It's a profound cooling of agitation. It's like a clearing in our lives, an open space that wasn't there before. It's a deep relaxation. And this cooling of agitation is expressed beautifully, I think, by another poetic image that the Buddha uses for the deepest and most complete letting go, Nibbana, or Nirvana, full awakening, or we might say full ripening. This Pali word means going out, ceasing to burn, or coming to an end, and sometimes you see it as unbinding. And this analogy came from an understanding of fire in ancient India, where fire burns, is agitated and trapped and full of heat because the fire element relies on its fuel. It clings to its fuel. So when fire lets go of its fuel, when we stop putting logs on a wood fire, for example, or we turn the gas off on a gas fire, the fire goes out. It cools, and in the ancient Indian understanding, it becomes free, unbound. So like this, Nibbana naturally arises as the conditions for clinging, holding on, stop coming together. So clinging doesn't go anywhere, just as fire doesn't go anywhere when it goes out. The question, where did the fire go, simply doesn't apply. We wouldn't think to ask that if we see a fire going on. In this sense, Nibbana doesn't look like anything, just as non-clinging doesn't look like anything. It doesn't have any particular form or texture or colour. It's simply an absence, a going out, a cooling. But it is expressed in the wise and compassionate action, thought and speech, springing from a free heart. A cool, non-agitated heart. A heart in which the fires of wanting, aversion and delusion, the fires of self-fabrication, all the doing that we do, have completely burned out. So in terms of Anapanasati, the insight themes of seclusion, dispassion and cessation have come to fruition. So we recognize its manifestation, just as we recognize a fire that's gone out, cooled, still, at peace. So it's just like this gradual, when we stop putting logs on the fire, it's not like an instant, you know, the fire's out. It's this gradual cooling and burning down of the embers. And so when we do let go, there's actually no one here doing anything at all. Rather, it's just presence being fully receptive to life, which is always fresh, unrehearsed. It's never been just like this before. Pema Chodron refers to this as being continually thrown out of the nest. I love that image. If we're living each moment practicing intimacy with life, this life, right here, now, we continually find ourselves in unknown territory. Everything fresh, everything alive and new. This is the awakened life. And so just like the oranges ripening on my potted tree, one day the conditions for that fruit continuing to stay attached to the tree, the conditions that keep it holding on, simply don't arise or come together anymore. So in Dharma terms, there's no fuel for clinging to happen at all anymore. At this instant, there's only one thing that can happen: the letting go. So while we can't do ripening, we can't do letting go, otherwise, like my striving example, it wouldn't be called letting go, we can keep cultivating skillful conditions for ripening and letting go to happen. So this is the good news. So there's one pith teaching that all Buddhist traditions converge upon that expresses the supreme ripening, this deepest letting go. In both the Satipatthana and Anapanasati suttas, the Buddha urges us to abide independently without clinging to anything in the world. And another way that we see this expressed in the suttas is nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as me or mine, or as I or mine. So this is the path of liberation through non-clinging, which is synonymous with letting go. So anything in the world is code for everything in our experienced world, because that's what the Buddha is interested in, our experience of being human. So everything that we experience through the physical senses, i.e. the body, and all of our feelings, perceptions, choices, and awareness, these are the aspects of mind, the Buddha's saying, don't cling to any of it. But we habitually cling to, we identify with and appropriate these aspects of experience, of body and mind, as me or mine, because we believe they're stable, that they're permanent and reliable. We've been talking about this aspect of seeing impermanence. And when we start looking, we realize it's all impermanent. It's all subject to continual change, and therefore it's unreliable. But conditions, you know, exist through change. We can't stop this happening. And Ajahn Chah says, just think, could you exhale without inhaling? Would it feel good? Or could you just inhale? You know, it's an impossibility. We want things to be permanent, but that can't be. Our moment-to-moment experience keeps changing. Sometimes that's pleasant, sometimes that's painful, and sometimes it's just plain confusing. But nothing can be held onto. Nothing is within our ultimate control, even though we keep trying this tack. We keep going back there a lot of times, don't we? We can't control the changing nature of these eyes, or the sights they see, or my awareness of that seeing. We can't control these ears, the sounds they hear, or my awareness of that hearing. We can't control the experience of this tongue, what it tastes, or my awareness of that tasting. We can't control the experience of the nose, what it smells, or the awareness of smelling. And we can't control the experience of mind, as you've probably been experiencing in meditation, what it thinks, or the awareness of that thinking. And this is what we practice with. This is the realm we're practicing with. Meeting the ever-changing nature of the experience as it comes through the sense doors into awareness. And we practice in seeing clearly what we attach to, what we cling to as mine, me, I. How we keep sort of damming up the flow of life that constantly creates contraction and therefore suffering. That means we miss the moments, the moment that's here and is already passing. For example, if only I could stop these distracting thoughts from coming to the mind. We're missing something there, yeah? Or if I could just let go of this tension in my hip, my retreat would be really great. But letting go is not an attitude of aversion to things or of repulsion or of resistance or of pushing things away. You know, sometimes we think that if I could just let go of this, i.e. if I could push it aside, everything would be fine. But rather, as we've seen, letting go is an outcome of the natural cooling, the dispassion, you know, this letting go of clinging, it's letting go and letting things be the way they are. This natural cooling that happens when we view things accurately as unstable, impermanent, and therefore unsatisfactory. In other words, it's not worth clinging to. Within such a way of looking, then, these lenses that we look through, there is, as Rob Verbier says, a lessening of the compulsive and deep-rooted tendencies to constantly pick up phenomena, grasp after them, fuss over them, and try to get rid of them. You know, this is the nature of obsession. We pick stuff up that's not ours to pick up, grasp after it, fuss over it, and try to get rid of it. It's a lot of energy going into this project. So in this cooling of letting go of things, we free things up. We free everything up. We can relax with what life presents to us moment to moment, and we stop reacting to it. We stop creating agitation or further agitation in the heart and mind. We stop clinging and just let things be. Letting be means that we become impartial, even-handed towards things with practice. We see then that things don't hold as much interest as they once did for the mind. And this is what we call dispassion, the coolness of heart and mind happening. Sometimes I've seen it written as holy disinterest, which I think is interesting. So the fire goes out, if you like, in our relationship with things. As we recognize that nothing that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think can bring lasting satisfaction, can bring any continued happiness or ease. In such moments of letting be, we might find ourselves feeling joy, freedom, a deep sort of inner contentment. And this inner contentment comes from the absence of the habitual push and pull of craving and clinging. It comes from this absence of the energetic and the mental gymnastics of wanting, rejecting, preferring this over that. So it's this dropping of the struggle, of this entanglement that we normally form around experience and objects of awareness. And then we recognize that in the deep embrace of this and the understanding of our own suffering lies our very freedom. And this feels and sounds counterintuitive, but it works. You know, the Buddha talked about, you know, this first noble truth is to understand our suffering, which means to meet it. If we recognize that all things are dukkha, if all things in our experience are unsatisfactory, we find that there comes to be a relationship of a kind of equality with all things, or equality to all things. And the tussle and agitation of preferring one thing over another, of pushing and pulling, calms. And then a different and really a very beautiful sense of things begins to emerge. Hakuin, the Zen poet and artist who lived in the 17th century, writes, "The monkey is reaching for the moon in the water. Until death overtakes him, he'll never give up. If he'd let go the branch and disappear in the deep pool, the whole world would shine with dazzling pureness. If we'd stop clinging to our concepts about experience, wanting life to be a certain way, in other words, if we'd let go the branch, we'd disappear in the deep pool of life. All the ripples in the heart-mind start settling. And this is the true meaning of equanimity, being equally near to all things, which we've talked about earlier. And whatever arises in experience can then shine clearly in its dazzling pureness without our distorted lenses of clinging and self-fabrication." And this doesn't mean that we become unfeeling, unmoving automatons, you know, like sitting like zombies amidst life, you know, experiencing this calm of equanimity. And nor does it lead to life becoming bland and two-dimensional or harsh and cold. And it's not that we stop responding or that we simply accept without objection whatever is happening around us. But rather, because we're freed from clinging to life being a certain way, the ripeness of our wisdom and compassion allows us to engage with life intimately, moment to moment to moment, without the agendas of the self getting in the way. This is the clarity of vision that comes with maturity of practice. And then we can be fully present, wide open, this wide open heart, receptive, and we can let the depth and richness of life move through us without interference, pleasant and painful without preference. And then our appropriate response to whatever we face is natural, supported, arising from that clarity. It's in alignment with the Dharma, if you like, in alignment with nature. And to finish, the Burmese teacher Sayadaw Utejaniya wrote, "And then we are simply residing in the ebb and flow of nature itself." Okay. Thank you. Let's just sit together for a few minutes.